Super Tuesday is huge for Donald Trump and equally big for Hillary Clinton. We'll break it all down for you on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. The biggest primary day of the year went pretty much as expected. Are the nomination battles over, or is there still life in them?
I think it is all over, bar the shouting, in the Democratic primary. I don't see how he can possibly catch up. In the Republican field, honestly, don't you think that if it was anybody else, we would say that Donald Trump is the presumptive candidate?
Next, the candidates turn their focus to Michigan. What should we be looking for?
There is a lot at stake. I mean, if John Kasich could actually win Michigan, that's very significant. Hillary Clinton has looked very strong. Donald Trump's message has resonated here in Michigan. It's a blue-collar state.
And we go back 62 years to an awful act of violence that happened on the House floor.
Ruthless, fanatic violence erupted in the halls of Congress. Three men and a woman believed to be members of the Puerto Rican nationalist gang that in November 1950 attempted the assassination of President Truman opened fire from the visitors' gallery of the House of Representatives.
That's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 117 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. Super Tuesday sucked all the oxygen out of the political news this week, but in the days leading up to it, there were a handful of mini-dramas that captured everyone's attention. First, there was the endorsement of Donald Trump by New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, a former rival.
I've been on that stage. I've gotten to know all the people on that stage, and there is no one who is better prepared to provide America with the strong leadership that it needs, both at home and around the world, than Donald Trump.
And, he added, he was convinced that Trump would be the strongest Republican candidate.
There is no doubt in my mind, and I've been saying this right from the time I entered the campaign, that the single most important thing for the Republican Party is to nominate the person who gives us the best chance to beat Hillary Clinton. I can guarantee you that the one person that Hillary and Bill Clinton do not want to see on that stage come next September is Donald Trump.
The Christie endorsement, thought to be a big plus for Trump, was contrasted with the controversy over David Duke, the former Klan leader and noted anti-Semite, who urged his followers to support the real estate mogul. CNN's Jake Tapper tried to get to the bottom of it with Trump.
Will you unequivocally condemn David Duke and say that you don't want his vote or that of other white supremacists in this election?
Well, just so you understand, I don't know anything about David Duke, okay? I don't know anything about what you're even talking about with white supremacy or white supremacists. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Did he endorse me or what's going on? Because, you know, I know nothing about David Duke. I know nothing about white supremacists. And so you're asking me a question that I'm supposed to be talking about people that I know nothing about.
Later on NBC's Today Show, Trump said that he misheard Tapper's questions, and he blamed it all on a bad earpiece. He eventually said that he disavowed Duke's support. That wasn't enough to mollify Marco Rubio, who in recent weeks has gone from an above-the-fray kind of candidate to one who was willing to get in the gutter and get under Trump's skin the way Trump has been doing to the other candidates.
You all have friends. You all have friends that are thinking about voting for Donald Trump. Friends, do not let friends vote for con artists. He called me Mr. Meltdown. Let me tell you something. Last night in the debate during one of the breaks, two of the breaks, he went backstage. He was having a meltdown. First, he had this little makeup thing applying, like, makeup around his mustache because he had one of those sweat mustaches. Then he asked for a full-length mirror. I don't know why because the podium goes up to here, but he wanted a full-length mirror. Maybe to make sure his pants weren't wet. I don't know. Then...
Welcome to kindergarten. And that was the lead-in to Super Tuesday, which brings us to this week's trivia question. Who was the last candidate who had the most votes in the primaries but failed to win his or her party's presidential nomination that year? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll give you the answer to last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned. It was a super Tuesday for the leading Republican and Democratic candidates. On the GOP side, Donald Trump won 7 primaries. Ted Cruz carried his must-win home state of Texas. Had he not, it could have spelled the end of him. And he won Oklahoma as well, and Alaska too. Marco Rubio, who was hoping for an upset win in Virginia, had to settle for the caucuses in Minnesota. On the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton swept the South, carried mostly by the sizable African-American vote. She won the top prize of the day in Texas, and she took Massachusetts, which had been a top Bernie Sanders target. For his part, Sanders won his home state of Vermont, the primary in Oklahoma, and caucuses in Minnesota and Colorado. Somehow, every candidate managed to declare Super Tuesday a success. But it's hard to make the case that anyone other than Trump and Clinton got what they wanted. Well, we got what we wanted. We got Neil Conan on this week's show to make sense of it all. Neil's a news analyst for Hawaii Public Radio and the former host of Talk of the Nation. And he joins us the first show of each month. Neil, it's great to have you back on the show and just in time.
I'm sorry, Ken, I couldn't quite hear you. The connection was bad. Did you say former host of the KKK Nation?
No. You know something? What I love about that Donald Trump story is that when he decided not to run for president as a Reform Party candidate in 2000, he said, well, it's been taken over by the David Dukes and the anti-Semites and Pat Buchanan.
Exactly.
And now he has no idea who David Duke is.
Of course, never heard of him.
The thing that kills me or fascinates me or whatever about having you on once a month, it's like, first of all, nobody reads a weekly magazine anymore because things happen so fast. You can't even have a weekly magazine. And here we have you on once a month. The last time we had you on, it was right after the Iowa caucuses, before the New Hampshire primary. That was 6 months ago.
Yeah. And you know, so much has changed. You know, Trump and Clinton looked unstoppable then.
Well, you know something? Okay. In that sense, not much has changed. Although we will say that the thought of Donald Trump as unstoppable last summer is just, I mean, well, that's a million years ago, yeah.
Beyond the realms of imagination last summer. And you know, don't you think this has been astonishing when Donald Trump can have a night like you just described, carrying Massachusetts and Texas?
Yeah, and Vermont, exactly. I mean, we talk about how Donald Trump is bad for the Republican Party, and we know that there are so many Republican leaders, who, whatever that means, who want to stop Donald Trump, and I don't know what that means. But then he wins in states in the Deep South. He wins, you know, and then he wins in Massachusetts. He wins in Vermont. So he's not a regional candidate. I don't know what he is, but he's certainly not a regional candidate.
You know, according to a lot of Republicans, he's not a Republican either. There is a visible recoil of the establishment, that, you know, the regular party, saying, you know, anybody but Trump, except for maybe not Cruz either.
Well, it was interesting to watch Cruz last night. We'll get to Ted Cruz in a minute, but I just think that watching Trump, you know, I mean, he won New Hampshire, he won Nevada, he won South Carolina, he carried 7 states on Tuesday night. He's favored next week in Michigan, and of course, you know, the upcoming weeks with Marco Rubio hoping to do well in Florida.
Oh, Marco Rubio has to hope better than to do well. If he doesn't win Florida, it's over.
That's right. That's what we said about Ted Cruz. And Ted Cruz actually had a decent night Tuesday had he not won Texas.
I'm not so sure I would call it a decent night. For him to be a realistic alternative or a realistic challenger to Donald Trump, I thought he had to carry a lot of those southern states where the evangelical vote played such a big part. And again, Ted Cruz lost the evangelical vote in places, you know, like Alabama and Georgia. Those are crucial losses for
right,
him.
Right, and it's true, because after he won Iowa, he was focusing on these southern states. This was going to be his firewall to protect him against any kind of Donald Trump surge elsewhere. But anyway, Ted Cruz on Tuesday night, I mean, he seemed to be having a good time with it, and here he is claiming victory.
Thank you, Texas! God bless the Lone Star State. And God bless the great state of Oklahoma.
Neil, have you ever heard somebody from Texas saying in Texas, God bless Oklahoma?
Much less the great state of Oklahoma. No, I have yet to hear that.
Is there somewhat like football rivalry or something between those two states?
A little bit, just a little bit, yes.
Although the rest of Ted Cruz's speech was basically a combination of hinting that his non-Trump rivals should drop out.
Republicans, together we have a choice. We are blessed with a deep, talented, honorable field. For the candidates who have not yet won a state, who have not racked up significant delegates, I ask you to prayerfully consider our coming together, uniting. For those who have supported other candidates, we welcome you on our team, standing united as one. That is the only way to beat Donald Trump.
And not only does he want to beat Donald Trump, he spent the rest of his speech ripping apart Donald Trump.
We can nominate a Washington dealmaker, profane and vulgar, who has a lifelong pattern of using government power for personal gain. Or we can nominate a proven conservative who has fought consistently for working men and women and to defend the Constitution.
Well, that was Ted Cruz. What do you make of the case that he is the alternative to Donald Trump?
On one hand, he's got an argument. He later in that speech said, you know, we're the only campaign that has beaten Donald Trump, not just once, but twice, but three times. He could throw in Alaska for a fourth, but that came in later. Then, of course, it was Marco Rubio eking out a victory in the caucuses in Minnesota. So that argument goes a little bit away. But the other part of that is where does Ted Cruz win from here? And remember that Ted Cruz is almost as despised by the Republican establishment as Donald Trump is.
If you're the Republican establishment, and again, I have no idea what the Republican establishment is, and you don't want Donald Trump, is the answer Ted Cruz, right?
Yeah, and that's, you know, what was it, Lindsey Graham who said it's the choice of shooting yourself or taking poison?
Or listening to the political junkie.
Well, that's the third alternative.
Anyway, we're talking about everybody, but Donald Trump, here he is declaring victory on Super Tuesday.
So I just want to say that this was an exciting evening. It's so great to be in Florida. It's so great to be at Mar-a-Lago with friends and the press and the media and everybody. I know it was a very tough night for Marco Rubio. He had a tough night, but he worked hard. He spent a lot of money. He is a lightweight, as I've said many times before. But you know what? We're going to go to Florida. We're going to spend so much time in Florida. We've got about a 20-point lead. I know that a lot of groups, a lot of the special interests, and a lot of the lobbyists and the people that want to have their little senator do exactly as they want. They're going to put $20 or $25 million into it over the next 2 weeks from what just came over the wires. And frankly, I think that's fine. As far as I'm concerned, it's fine. And if he wins, they'll have total control. But he's not going anywhere anyway. But we'll see what happens. But we're going to spend a lot of time in Florida. The Virginia win was just a great win because it's a place that is just spectacular and a place that we have big investments in, as we have in Florida. Remember, well, we have thousands of employees in Florida, all along Miami, Doral and Mar-a-Lago and so many other places. And it's been an amazing place to invest. It's been amazing to have so many wonderful employees, some of whom are here tonight, really urging us on. And, you know, I have thousands of employees all over the country, actually all over the world. But for purposes of tonight, we'll just say all over the country. And it's been so beautiful to watch this company grow and to watch it grow so strongly. Recent articles came out talking about how great a company we built.
Neil, is he running for the president of Trump Enterprises, or is he running for president of the United States? It sounds like a business proposition.
Well, it sounds like a business proposition, but the entertainment value in all of that was watching the man in the background, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who introduced Donald Trump last night and sat there behind him looking as if he had just swallowed a weasel.
Well, you know something? I could not take my eyes off Chris Christie. It was the weirdest thing. You know, when he was during the presidential debates, and you know how he would look into the camera, and he would be, actually, he would be looking at me, Kenny. He was looking at me. My knees would buckle. I said, oh, God, Chris Christie is looking right at me. Well, this, except on Tuesday night when he was standing behind Donald Trump, he was staring at Donald Trump's the back of his head or something, but he just didn't flinch or move. It was the weirdest thing. And if that was a tryout for vice president, that was a very strange tryout for vice president.
Very strange. Yeah, you know, what have I done was the expression on his face.
Also, I thought that was very interesting. Not that I expect Donald Trump to be gracious, but we'll get to the Democrats in a second. But when Hillary Clinton claimed victory on Tuesday night, she was very gracious, saying Bernie Sanders fought a great fight. If you want to unite the party, if you're the clear front runner, if you win 7 out of 11 contests, you're heavily favored in Florida on March 15th, why bother calling Marco Rubio a lightweight? Why not just, I mean, I'm asking stupid questions here because I don't know the answer to them, or maybe I know the answer.
He can't help himself. This is what he does. And, you know, the performance Tuesday night was, you know, relatively subdued by Trumpian standards. And all of a sudden, you know, people are calling, well, he's made the turn. He's looking president. Are you joking?
You're right. Well, one more thing about Marco Rubio. I mean, he won Minnesota. He finished a strong second in Virginia. But he blames John Kasich for his loss in Virginia. But I don't know. It's just Kasich with Ohio, Rubio in Florida. March 15th could be, basically cutting the Republican field in half.
You know, the only other part of it is if, and this is a long shot if, because right now Donald Trump is leading in Ohio and leading, as you mentioned, big in Florida, according to the polls. But if John Kasich can win in Ohio, and if Marco Rubio can win in Florida, those are winner-take-all states, all of a sudden, maybe you get to the convention and Donald Trump does not have a lock on the first ballot.
Yeah, well, of course, starting March 15th, you have the winner-take-all primaries, and even if the other candidates stay in, all he has to do is win by a plurality, and he gets all the delegates. So the numbers do favor him.
Yeah, they do. Absolutely, they do. And right now, you'd have to say, you know, odds-on favorite. Can we start using the word tantamount?
Yeah. When you hosted Talk of the Nation, and we talked about winners in Democratic primaries and overwhelmingly Democratic districts, or winners in Republican primaries and overwhelmingly Republican districts, you would always say, well, that was tantamount to victory. You love that word.
I love that word.
Here's another word you haven't heard in a long time, Ben Carson.
Yeah. What is he still doing in the race?
Well, that's a good question, because as we speak this Wednesday afternoon, he issued a statement, says he sees no path forward for his campaign. He will skip Thursday's GOP debate in Detroit, and he's going to announce his political future in a speech Friday at CPAC, which is having its conference in the Washington area this weekend. So we may get a little answer about Ben Carson, who was won nowhere. Once upon a time, he was a front runner. But then again, once upon a time, Neil Conan was the front runner. Everybody was a front runner. Okay, so let's go to the Democrats for a second. Obviously, a big night for Hillary Clinton, and it sounded like that listening to her speech.
Thank you. Thank you all so much. What a super Tuesday.
And it was clear she was already thinking about November.
Now, it's clear tonight that the stakes in this election have never been higher. And the rhetoric we're hearing on the other side has never been lower. Trying to divide America between us and them is wrong, and we're not going to let it work.
You know, Neil, we knew that once we passed Iowa and New Hampshire, we got into the South, this would be great terrain for Hillary Clinton. We saw it in her remarkably overwhelming victory in South Carolina last Saturday. We saw it Tuesday in the Deep South states. The black vote was just, I mean, I think in many ways it was larger for her than it was for Barack Obama in 2008.
I think you're right about that. In 2008, then-candidate Clinton had a call on the loyalties of some African-American voters, and Well, she got some of that vote in 2008, not a lot. But this time around, clearly, Bernie Sanders had not done his work in the Deep South with African-American communities. His campaign virtually gave up in places like Alabama and even Virginia, where he did badly as well, certainly in Texas. And it was just overwhelming, the margins that Hillary Clinton racked up in those states. But the one that I think had to sting Bernie Sanders yesterday, don't you think, was Massachusetts.
Absolutely. That was one of the states, white, liberal, progressive, the kind of state that he thought he could win. And while he did win Minnesota, he won Vermont, he won Oklahoma primary, he won the caucuses in Minnesota, they said, and Colorado. But Massachusetts, I thought, was his state. And I'm wondering if maybe one of the reasons he gave a speech, his Super Tuesday victory speech so early from Vermont, is maybe he felt it would not be a good night for him.
Well, it was going to be a bad night anyway, given what was going to happen in the Deep South. Massachusetts, I think, made it a disastrous night. Yes, yeah. He won Oklahoma, and people say, well, Oklahoma, that's about the reddest state in the union. Well, there's that, you know, sort of Fred Harris, a name you and I will both remember, that Fred Harris strain in the Democratic Party in Oklahoma, that populist strain. And so I don't think it makes a lot of sense for Bernie Sanders to do well in the Democratic Party in Oklahoma.
You'll be happy to know, because this is useless trivia week on Political Junkie, but Eugene V. Debs' second best state in the 1912 candidate campaign, when he was running as a Socialist Party candidate for president, was Oklahoma.
Well, another socialist doing well in Oklahoma.
Exactly. Well, anyway, if you listen to how Bernie Sanders sounded on Tuesday night, he did not sound defeated at all.
At the end of tonight, 15 states will have voted, 35 states remain. And let me assure you that we are going to take our fight for economic justice, for social justice, for environmental sanity, for a world of peace to every one of those states. Now, Wall Street may be against us, and the super PACs may be against us, but you know why we are going to win? Because our message is resonating, and the people, when we stand together, will be victorious.
Well, Neil, you know, he's getting the crowds, he's getting the support, he's getting donations. Certainly he's funded, he's well-funded. He's brought a lot of young voters to the forefront, but in a Democratic primary where the black vote, where the Latino vote is paramount, and he shows no signs of winning there, he's going to have to win somewhere soon. And you have Michigan, Florida, Illinois, North Carolina, Ohio coming up. Where does he win?
I'm not sure where he wins. And he has to not only win, at this point, Hillary Clinton, in terms of pledged delegates, not even counting the superdelegates, in terms of pledged delegates, is further ahead of Bernie Sanders than, at this point in the race, Barack Obama was ahead of her. As you know, it is really hard to play catch up in the Democratic primary. And he not only has to win, so he has to win by big margins in places like Ohio. He seems to have virtually written off Florida because it's a closed primary. You won't get any independents voting for him there. The math starts to get really remorseless. You heard his advisors on Wednesday saying, look, we really only targeted five states on Super Tuesday, and we won four, and we're going to split the votes in the other one, which is Massachusetts, split the delegates. And if that's right, that's right. But nevertheless, you know, where do you catch up? I just don't see it.
Neil, okay, so a report card so far. After Super Tuesday, 15 states have voted thus far, 35 to go, if assuming we still have 50 states. What's your report card? Is it over? Is there still a race to be? Is there still a race to be had? What's happening?
As you point out, I think Bernie Sanders is going to stay in. He raised, what, $42-45 million in February, so there's no reason for him not to stay in. But at this point, I think he's just angling for the best speaking spot at the convention that will nominate Hillary Clinton as the Democratic nominee for president of the United States. I think it is all over, bar the shouting, in the Democratic primary. I don't see how he can possibly catch up. In the Republican field, well, honestly, Ken, don't you think that if it was anybody else, we would say that Donald Trump is the presumptive candidate?
He's heads and shoulders over everybody else. And again, as we said before, here come the winner-take-all primaries where where I don't see any signs of his momentum being stopped.
And 35% is going to be enough to win all of the delegates from big delegate-rich states that are coming up. And, you know, if the field doesn't winnow out and if Ben Carson pulls out, okay. But that doesn't really make that much difference. If there are three other candidates dividing up the vote, Donald Trump wins with that plurality, and I can't see how he can be stopped.
Even if Ben Carson pulls out, where would his supporter go?
I don't know.
That was a cheap shot, but that's what we do on the Political Junkie.
Absolutely.
And Neil Conan is a news analyst with Hawaii Public Radio and the former host of Talk of the Nation. He joins us the first show of each month on the Political Junkie. Neil, we'll see you in April, and let's see what candidates will still be with us.
Okay, Ken, talk to you next month.
The next big prize on the presidential primary schedule is Michigan, which votes next week. The Wolverine state has been a key focus for Democratic and Republican candidates. Hillary Clinton has often talked about the dreadful water situation in Flint and the response from the state's Republican governor. John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, has said that his path to the GOP nomination was to win Michigan and then take his own state the following week. Susan Demas is the publisher and editor of Inside Michigan Politics, a highly respected newsletter covering the state's political scene. Susan, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me.
You know, we spent so much time focusing on Super Tuesday that I'm only now catching my breath, but we have Michigan next week, so tell me what's at stake.
Well, right now, if you look at the polling, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are running away with it in their respective contests. So I can't guarantee you that it's going to be a super exciting night next week. But there is a lot at stake. I mean, if John Kasich can put up a good fight, if he could actually win Michigan, that's very significant. That would certainly help him with his march to Ohio. On the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton has looked very strong. If she is able to take Michigan and take a really good chunk of our delegates, I'm not sure how Bernie Sanders can claw his way back.
You know, we talk about how important Michigan is, and I remember Michigan has played consequential roles in nominating battles in the past. But as you say, if this is Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, an extension of what they did, so how they did so well on Super Tuesday, then I just wonder if the rest of the states are going to fall in line like this. But right now, Michigan, you're saying, looks pretty predictable, right?
It does look predictable. I'm curious to see if the polls are moving at all after Super Tuesday, especially on the Republican side. I mean, you did see Ted Cruz amass three states. Marco Rubio won his first state. Maybe the numbers will shift a little bit, but I do think that Donald Trump's message has resonated here in Michigan. It's a blue-collar state. A lot of people who've been left behind with this economy like the message that he is selling in terms of bringing jobs back, you know, however impractical that is. They like his anti-immigration message. So I think he is well positioned here.
Is there anybody on TV? Are the airwaves being blanketed or is it mostly ignored?
Thus far, we're seeing a lot of ads on the Democratic side. Both Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton have been up since last week. And so, you know, you're seeing them on a loop. On the Republican side, I'm not sure if people are going to be spending as much money.
My first instinct is to ask about endorsements, although I know that endorsements in the last several primaries and caucuses have not meant that much. I know Bill Schuette, the attorney general, was for Jeb Bush. Are there any key endorsements that we should know about in both the Democratic and Republican contests?
You know, what you're seeing is that the endorsements are kind of scattered on the Republican side, especially now that Jeb Bush is out. He really had vacuumed up quite a few of them. Marco Rubio has the endorsement of a few members of Congress here, Congressman John Molinar, Congressman Dan Benishek up in the Upper Peninsula, Phil Huizenga over on the west side of the state. John Kasich has the endorsement of the state Senate Majority Leader Arlen Neikoff. Ted Cruz has gotten the support of Congressman Justin Amash, who's from Western Michigan. Over on the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders does not have any official endorsements. It's completely Clinton country, you know, from everybody from former governors like Jennifer Granholm and Jim Blanchard to both of our senators, Gary Peters, Debbie Stabenow, Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan. So, you know, you can kind of see the way the establishment wind is blowing over on the Democratic side.
We see this nationwide, but how big is the situation in Flint statewide, and are the candidates addressing it? I know Hillary Clinton has talked about it a lot.
Yeah, the Flint water crisis really is still dominating headlines all over Michigan. Just over the weekend, Governor Rick Snyder released thousands of emails about what his administration has done and did not do in terms of the crisis. And so, you know, the stories are just not going away. And the health problems for the people of Flint are not going away. People are still testing positive for lead. So it is a huge story. I think all of the presidential candidates are going to be asked about it. It hasn't been a big issue on the Republican side, although, you know, you did see that Senator Ted Cruz actually for a while was holding up an aid bill for Flint in Congress. So I'm sure he'll be asked about that. But the Democrats have really latched on to this issue. It's a huge issue for their base. Obviously, Flint is a poor city. It's an African-American city. They care about this issue. And you've seen that, and that both Clinton and Sanders have gone up to Flint and campaigned there.
What's the view of Governor Snyder in the state? I know many Democrats, and I think Hillary Clinton as well, have called for his resignation. Not that that's going to happen, but what's the view of him in the state?
Both Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton are using Rick Snyder as a political pinata right now. And, you know, that's what they're going to do in a Democratic primary. I think he has certainly taken a hit with Michigan voters. If you look at some polling that the Detroit Free Press did back in January, his handling of this crisis, it has not gone over well with voters, not even with Republicans. And Democrats are calling for his head.
Hmm. Less than a week to go before the primary. The front runners, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, and that's the way you see the primary next week?
Yeah, I am loathe to make predictions most of the time, but I think the trend lines are pretty clear for both Clinton and Trump here in Michigan next week.
A lot of delegates at stake, right?
Yeah, there are 60 delegates at stake on the Republican side, 140 delegates on the Democratic side. So Michigan is a big prize.
Susan Demas is the publisher and editor of Inside Michigan Politics. Susan, it was great having you on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Michigan seems like a dream to me now. It took me 4 days to hitchhike from Saginaw. I've come to look for America. Laughing on the bus, playing games with the faces.
The focus on Super Tuesday was, of course, the presidential primaries. But the battle for control of Congress has also begun, with primaries in Alabama, Arkansas, and Texas on Tuesday, Mississippi next week, Illinois, Ohio, and North Carolina later this month, and so on. It will get intense. Jennifer Duffy is a senior editor for the Cook Political Report and is a leading expert in Senate and House races. Jennifer, welcome back to the Political Junkie.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
You know, we were talking right before we came on the air right now, and we were thinking that all the focus on the presidential race and Super Tuesday and all that, but there is a battle for control of Congress that's up as well.
Well, absolutely. I think that that battle takes place more in the Senate than in the House, simply because the House has been gerrymandered to the point where even if Democrats have an exceptional night, it's going to be hard for them to pick up the 30 seats they need to get a majority in the House. They're going to pick up seats. There's no question about that. But getting to that number is really difficult.
And how many seats do the Democrats need in the Senate?
In the Senate, well, it depends who wins the White House. They need 4 seats if they keep the White House. They need 5 if they don't keep the White House.
Because of the vice presidential tie-breaking.
Exactly. Right, and there are enough seats in play that it is fair to say that the majority is in play.
Tell me how many seats are up and tell me what are Democratic seats, what are Republican seats?
Well, interestingly enough, if you remember back to 2014 and Republicans picking up 9 seats, it's because every factor that matters was on their side. It is a reversal of fortune for them in 2016. There are a total of 34 races up. Republicans have to defend 24 seats. Democrats only have to defend 10. One of the things that we've learned in the last several election cycles is that presidential performance matters. Which party carried a state in a presidential election matters. And again, in 2014, you had Democrats defending a number of red states that Mitt Romney carried in 2012 by as much as 27 points. So this time, there are 7 seats, Republican held seats, that Obama carried. There's a difference, though. You know, Obama lost seats, you know, in 2012 by double digits. And in this case...
2012 or 2010?
In 2012, he lost a number of states by double digits that had Senate races in 2014. In this case, the Republican states he won in 2012, he didn't win by quite as much. The outlier here is his home state of Illinois, where Mark Kirk, Republican, is up for re-election. He carried that by 17 points. Everything else is in single digits, which means that these incumbents, they're in a position to fight. However, there are complications in a presidential cycle, not the least of which is the top of the ticket, who the nominees are.
Let me ask you about that, because not always has the top of the ticket filtered down. I mean, I remember George McGovern in 1972 was a disaster at top of the ticket, but it didn't really hurt the Democrats because they separated themselves from that. But if Donald Trump is the presidential nominee, and he looks like he is, what does that do to the Mark Kirks or the Rob Portmans in Ohio's of the world or the Ron Johnsons in Wisconsin, where the states may be not susceptible to a Donald Trump candidacy?
Frankly, you know, I think that these senators are in a terrible place. It's a damned if you do, damned if you don't. I mean, they can't walk away from Trump because they lose a large part of their base. They can't embrace him because then they lose the moderates and some of the independents that they actually need to win in these swing states. So they are not in a good place. But you made an excellent point in that if they do it right, they have a chance at surviving, certainly. But Democrats are going to hold their feet to the fire on this. They've already started. They're trying to get all these senators on the record as to who they're going to support. Most of them are being very smart right now and saying that they'll support the Republican nominee, whoever that is. But it's going to be a real part of this battle. So here becomes the question. Suppose Trump loses Ohio, right? How much does he have to lose it by to take Rob Portman down with him? Rob Portman is running probably the best Senate campaign in the country right now. I mean, operating on all cylinders, money, you know, the ground game is sort of being fully implemented.
But the polls showed very close with his rival.
Show it very close. So if that is true, is it 5 points? You know, can he survive a 5-point Trump loss? Can he survive an 8-point Trump loss? We don't know that yet. But it's something that's in the back of every campaign manager's head right now.
But then you think of states like North Dakota and Montana, who, while these Senate races were not during the presidential cycle, but Obama got clobbered in these two states. And yet in the most recent cycles, Democrats picked up Senate seats in North Dakota and Montana, or they kept their seat in Montana.
Right. You know, and I think that that had to do with a couple of things. One, the strength of the candidates that they ran.
That always matters.
Of the Republican.
Right.
They're fairly small states. They're states where you probably have met the candidates.
Right. And met everybody else in the state.
What
do you make of the fact that, I mean, at least as of Super Tuesday, we saw the Republican turnout jump tremendously compared to 2008, while the Democratic turnout was much, much less. For all the nervousness and the worry about Donald Trump at the top of the ticket, does he potentially bring new voters to the process where that could help the Republican Party?
You know, I think that's unclear. Obviously, the increase you see is very personality driven. I think we got a long way to go to the general election. You could also say, though, that he could really drive turnout on the Democratic side as well, especially among minorities.
Right.
There were some good news for Senate Republicans on Tuesday night. There were two incumbent senators who faced primaries.
Alabama and Arkansas.
Right. Now, Richard Shelby in Alabama hasn't had a contested primary, probably since the 1980s.
When he was a Democrat.
Probably, you're right, when he was a Democrat. He took this very seriously, ran a full-fledged campaign. He spent about $5.5 million on television advertising, which, by the way, in Alabama is a lot of money. You know, he was running against an outsider, somebody who painted him as the establishment. He walked away with 65% of the vote. I think that that is encouraging given the strength of Trump's
win in
the state.
They were nervous that Trump voters would come out and oppose Shelby because he was the establishment.
Right, that a Trump voter was not a Shelby voter.
And Trump won the Alabama big.
Exactly. And Shelby outperformed him.
Right.
Then you have Arkansas, where you have Senator John Bozeman. He was elected in 2010. He's a very laid-back guy. There's some concern about him, but he also produced a very strong primary win, about 73%, against somebody who's a known quantity, a Tea Party candidate who's a known quantity and had some personal money. So I think that the fact that Trump can win these states and Republican senators could succeed in their primaries, if I'm a Republican strategist, I kind of see that as positive.
There was some concern once upon a time that Shelby might be in some kind of difficulty in the primary. Do you see any of the current senators up this year who may have troubles in the primary?
Appreciate the fact that there are a lot of filing deadlines that haven't closed yet.
Right.
Until the filing closes in Alaska, you know, you're going to be concerned about Lisa Murkowski.
Lisa Murkowski lost the Republican primary 6 years ago.
Exactly.
Won as a third party, as a write-in.
Everybody in Alaska now knows how to spell Murkowski. So you're going to worry about somebody like a Kelly Ayotte until that filing deadline closes.
John McCain.
Although I think some of his biggest competition has already walked away. He does have a primary opponent. She's a former state senator named Kelly Ward. She doesn't seem to be getting a lot of traction. In these primaries, it's one of the things you look at is, are they getting support from these Tea Party-affiliated groups like the Club for Growth, the Senate Conservative Fund? She has not collected that yet, but that doesn't mean that somebody else may get in. There's some video of Senator McCain saying he would support Trump, and he looks like he's swallowing a very bitter pill as he's saying it.
Bozeman on Tuesday night also said that if Trump is the nominee, I will support him.
You know, it's about party. It's about the base right now, and this is sort of the place they have to be at the moment. The only senator who has said he won't support Trump under any circumstances is Ben Sasse from Nebraska. He is not up in 16.
And a very strong conservative, elected with strong Tea Party support.
Well, exactly. And the argument he makes is that Donald Trump is no constitutional conservative. He'd be right on that, of course. But he says that he may even leave the party.
In 2 weeks, we have Illinois, we have North Carolina, we have Ohio. What should we be looking for in those states? All three states have Republican incumbents. So,
all three states have Republican incumbents, but I think it says something that unlike the last two or three cycles, they are not fending off tough primary challenges. Everybody's got a minor challenge, everybody's got tough. Democrats have some interesting primaries, and I say that only because Democrats have, you know, probably since 2008, gone out of their way to avoid primaries wherever they can. But they have an interesting one in Ohio. Former Governor Ted Strickland is their candidate of choice, but he's being challenged by a councilman from Cincinnati named P.G. Sittenfeld, who is running to Strickland's left.
Right.
31, very energetic. Has gotten some newspaper endorsements that have surprised me. He's very much an underdog.
Strickland is 71 years old, too. It's a big contrast in age.
It's true. If Strickland were to win this seat in the fall, he would be the oldest incoming freshman in Senate history.
Wow.
And people go, nope, she's wrong, Frank Lautenberg. But Lautenberg was in the Senate before he came back to the Senate. Right. He doesn't really count.
No. We have Bob Torricelli to thank for that.
Exactly. Right. You know, I think Strickland's favored to win, but I also
in
think...
In the primary.
In the primary, but I also think that Sittenfeld has exposed some vulnerabilities in the general election.
Is that a little bit, could you compare it to Sanders versus Clinton in some ways?
If Sittenfeld had a tenth of the money that Sanders had, it would all be, you could make that comparison, certainly.
What about North Carolina?
North Carolina, you know, I think that Democrats ended up with a string of second-tier candidates. They have...
Richard Burr is the Republican incumbent.
Richard Burr is the Republican incumbent. There's a trend in polling in North Carolina that we've seen, God, over three or four cycles, that incumbents are not well-known. Voters don't have strong opinions on them. They sort of are very undefined. I think that for Democrats to win in North Carolina, though, in this cycle, the top of the ticket really has to collapse. The other pressure on Burr is what I think is going to be the closest governor's race in the country is going to happen in North Carolina. And then in Illinois, again, Democrats got behind Congresswoman Tammy Duckworth. They like her story. You know, she is a veteran. She lost her legs in combat
in Iraq.
But she is getting a very energetic challenge from a woman named Andrea Zopp, who has been very active in Cook County Democratic politics for a long time. She's actually a very good candidate, African-American. She doesn't have the money Duckworth has, but she's taken some fair shots at Duckworth. It wouldn't be surprise me to see her overperform. But again, I look at her as the underdog here.
When we always talk about Senate races, we always talk about, as you pointed out earlier, top of the ticket. In summary, assuming it's Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump, and the Democrats need a net gain of four seats, and you have vulnerable Republican incumbents in Illinois, Ohio, Wisconsin, at least those three.
Let's look at them. There's the open seat in Florida.
Right.
Illinois, Wisconsin, Ohio, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania. There's six seats right there.
That's right.
The challenge for Republicans is that of the 10 Democratic seats up, they only have a shot at one of them, and that's the open seat in Nevada.
Not even Colorado?
Colorado, maybe. There's a really crowded primary. It's late. I think that they have a 50-50 shot of getting a good candidate out of that primary or a complete disaster. Let's see what happens. But right now, it is a very crowded, undefined race. You have a couple of candidates with money. Let's see what happens there.
We never could have predicted Donald Trump 6 months ago. We have 6 months or more to go before the general election. Tell me quickly, Jennifer Duffy, do the Republicans keep the Senate?
If Trump is the nominee, I think Republicans have a very, very hard time keeping it. I'd say that the odds are not in their favor.
Jennifer Duffy is a senior editor for the Cook Political Report, and she focuses on House and Senate races. Jennifer, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
The choice is yours to make.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, what presidential candidate in a competitive battle for the nomination clinched his party's nod the earliest? The answer, John McCain in 2008. By March 4th of that year, a combination of enough delegates and the dropouts of the other candidates clinched the Republican nomination for him. And the randomly selected winner is Gary Sanders of New York City. Gary wins the coveted political junkie button. And we have a scuttlebutt puzzle winner as well. That's that waste of time contest where you need to take a word or concept from each button I post and then come up with a familiar saying or slogan. The first button said, Bush's tax plan, you're gonna pay. The second was a button of the Tin Man from The Wizard of Oz. And the third one showed the letters ING on a plain green button. This was a clever button for former Alaska Senator Ernest Greening. So when you combine pay with the Tin Man, with a button that said ING, ing, you kind of get Peyton Manning, the quarterback of the Super Bowl champions Denver Broncos. And the winner is Tug Ricks of Henderson, Nevada. As always, check out our website for the latest campaign updates, super scuttle button puzzles, political columns, trivia questions, and more. Go to krpoliticaljunkie.com.
Peyton, it's feeling right now, your second Super Bowl, but what a season it was for you to get this win today. What does that mean?
Well, it's very special, Tracy. This game was much like this season has been. It really tested our toughness, our resilience, our unselfishness, and so it's only fitting it kind of turned out that way. And great bunch of teammates, great bunch of guys I got to play with, and I just feel very, very grateful.
It's time for This Week in Political History. We like to say that nothing happens in Congress anymore. We wish that were the case on March 1, 1954. On that day, several Puerto Rican nationalists began shooting from the visitors' gallery onto the floor of the House of Representatives. Five congressmen were wounded, including one quite seriously. In the immediate aftermath, several House pages attended to the lawmakers who were shot, putting them on stretchers and getting them out of harm's way. One of those pages was Paul Kanjorski, who decades later served some 26 years in the House as a Democrat from Pennsylvania until his defeat in 2010. He joins us now to remember that frightening day 62 years ago this week. Congressman Kanjorski, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Well, thank you, Ken. It's been 62 years.
62
wow.
years, yeah, I know. Yeah, it was yesterday, right?
Yeah, yeah.
In your memory, when you look back at that day, how did that day start?
It was an average day, and we just got into average material on the floor. And then all of a sudden, this cut loose in the afternoon, early afternoon. And then, of course, we sort of functioned at our jobs without thinking about the long-term ramifications. But later on in the day, when we all got together and talked about it, it became apparent that we had lived through a significantly historical event.
Well, tell me, where were you when the shooting started? How old were you? Who were you working for? Tell me what you remember.
That was in my second year, as a page. And not all pages were there because that was the day the academy examinations for West Point and Annapolis, et cetera, were being held. So those that were interested in going to the academies were absent. So we were sort of on short shift, if you will. I was on the floor, and that means sitting in the corner back there and moving up in your seat until you get a ring on the floor to go service someone on the floor. And that's what I was doing. As a matter of fact, I was sitting in the first seat when the buzzer went off. I knew where it was, got up, took about four steps, and that's when it started. And it started in such a way that it sounded like firecrackers. But I realized very quickly that it was shots because as a kid, back in Pennsylvania, I'd spent a lot of time, you know, shooting pistols. And when a bullet hits a hard rock, it usually makes a particular ping, and it also causes the rock to shatter and fly. And that's what I felt right above my head. I heard one of the cracks hit the marble column, and it sprayed me. So I immediately concluded it was a bullet of some sort hit the floor.
How old were you at the time?
I was I was 15.
Wow. Do you remember the shooters yelling anything?
They unraveled a flag and were shouting, in Spanish, I think, something about Puerto Rico independence. But, you know, I was not aware of the political circumstance in Puerto Rico and the striving for independence there. That was the furthest thing from my mind. Then we were, you know, doing other things. And, of course, you know, when you're Page, you said you spent some time on the Hill. But those of us that have been fortunate enough to spend time on the Hill get an adrenaline shot from it. So everything we do is so connected to important things, you know. And at that time, things were a lot less formal than they are now, so that it wouldn't be strange to walk around a corner and walk into the president, who may be visiting for a meeting up there, because that was rather common. Of course, if it were today, that wouldn't happen.
On that day, on March 1st, do you remember thinking that you might have been at risk of getting shot yourself?
Honestly, not. Those shots went out. I hit the floor. I got up. I went on to where the call section was. And then there were several members laying around the floor, somewhat moaning. And then so I zipped right back to Bill. Bill was right behind me.
Bill Emerson.
Yeah. And I said, you know, we've got some dangerous things here. Do we have any stretchers? And we sent some other pages to get stretchers. And we started right into response mode. So we didn't really give a lot of thought or think about our own involvement in it until it was over later on in the afternoon.
When we mentioned Bill Emerson, let me just point out, he was a page with you back in the day, and then he also later served in Congress, as you did. He was a Republican from Missouri. There's a famous photograph of you among those carrying a stretcher out of the House chamber. I mean, I just remember both Bill Emerson is like pointing or yelling, and you're holding up the stretcher. That, I mean, for a 15-year-old, that must have been a surreal day.
It was an issue. We carried three members out. There were five members injured, and Bill and I had a team. We had about five or six pages and stretcher, and we would go in and out and carry them down to the ambulances, which were in the parkade down there in front of the Capitol. And then finally, when we got the last one out, we actually got into the ambulance and went to the hospital with them.
Somebody said that you can still see the bullet holes in the House chamber and some of the desks today?
Oh, yes. The majority, there's a beautiful shot that went through the table on the majority leader or minority leader, depending, on the Republican side of the chamber. And it's been filled in, but it's very clear that it's a bullet hole. And then there are some other bullet holes in the ceiling that are still observable. And now they did a pretty good patch job on the columns. For instance, the column that got hit just in front of me when I got up, you really have to know that there was a shot fired, and that's been filled in. It's practically totally removed.
You first ran for Congress in the 1980s.
1980 election, right, a special election.
Right, and then you were elected in 84. When you were elected and when you were on the House floor, did memories of this event come back to you?
Oh, there's really never a day that I go on the House floor that I don't remember that occasion, where it happened, where the location was of people. And the chamber hasn't changed that much since 1954. I mean, the carpet is, you know, a different color and everything. And, of course, you know, off and on over those last 62 years. Wow. And, of course, Bill now is deceased, but Bill and I carried on a lifetime friendship. And so he stayed on the Hill and worked on the staff and then eventually as chief of staff to some of the senators. And then he ran in 80 and I ran in 80. He was a Republican, I was a Democrat. He won, I lost, and didn't come back for another 4 years. But then we spent, you know, the next 20, not 20, but about 15 years together telling stories about what happened and enjoyed ourselves. It was sort of those weird things that you have a childhood friendship. See, we were also roommates, and we were really best of friends. And, he traveled to my home at vacations. I traveled to his home. We visited each other in college, in law school. You know, it was a long-term. I remember bringing my wife up to meet him right after he got married. He was in Washington. So we had a real long, involved friendship. And then Joanne served with me after Bill died.
Joanne, Bill Emerson's widow, yes.
Right, and she is a wonderful girl. But we were all very, very, very close.
It was like yesterday, wasn't it?
No. Puerto Rico has a special meaning to me because of that event now. And I imagine that won't leave me until my days are over. So, you know, if I could leave another word off this depressing subject, I wish that we hadn't done away with the Page program. Because there were so many of us that had the opportunity to have that experience and then come back to Washington to serve. And I'm sure I probably would have never run for Congress and served in Congress those 26 years, nor would the bill, if we hadn't been pages. That's where we decided what we wanted to do with the rest of our lives.
Paul Kanjorski is a Democrat from Pennsylvania who served 26 years in Congress from 1985 through 2010. Congressman, thank you so much for sharing your memories with us.
Ken, it's been a pleasure. I'm glad I still have the memories to share with you.
It was 62 years ago this week, on March 1st, 1954, when an act of terror on the House floor injured five lawmakers and made headlines everywhere.
In Washington, D.C., ruthless, fanatic violence erupted in the halls of Congress. Three men and a woman, believed to be members of the Puerto Rican nationalist gang that in November 1950 attempted the assassination of President Truman, opened fire from the visitors' gallery of the House of Representatives. Estimates of the numbers of shots fired range from 15 to 30, and each bullet hole found is a grim reminder to those who were present of the terrible surprise attack.
Ambulances are rushed to the Capitol, along with doctors from a nearby naval hospital. Alvin Bentley, wounded near the heart and in the stomach, is carried out while police push our cameraman aside. Bentley's condition is still reported as critical. Clifford Davis, a Democrat leader, was wounded in the right leg. In the excitement, a doorkeeper, William Belcher, suffered a heart attack. Republican Ben Jensen received several severe wounds in the back. Many other congressmen escaped death by inches in the chamber.
You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie. That's it for this week's show. Political Junkie is produced at WAMU in Washington and is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. For political columns, trivia questions, scuttlebutt puzzles, and bad jokes, and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter, check out our website at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or shoot us a message on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Our show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins. Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer, and Alex Drewinskis is our engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.